One of the duelists was a very young man, dressed in fine, loose gentleman's clothing of a fashionable cut. He wore optics, and his hair hung to his shoulders in well-tended ringlets. His red-jacketed opponent was a great deal older, a bit hunched over and weathered. He looked active and determined enough to pose a threat, however. Each man held a lightweight crossbow, what Camorri thieves would call an alley piece. "Gentlemen," said the younger duelist's second, "please, can there be no accommodation? If the Lashani gentleman will withdraw his imprecation," added the younger duelist, his voice was high and nervous, "I would be eminently satisfied with the merest recognition." "No, there cannot," said the man standing beside the older duelist. "His lordship is not in the habit of tendering apologies for mere statements of obvious fact." "With the merest recognition," continued the young duelist desperately, "that the incident was an unfortunate misunderstanding, and that it need not—"
"Were he to condescend to speak to you again," said the older duelist second, "his lordship would no doubt also note that you wail like a bitch, and would inquire as to whether you're really capable of biting like one."
The younger duelist stood speechless for a few seconds, then gestured rudely toward the older men with his free hand.
"I am forced," said his second, forced to allow that there may be no accommodation. Let the gentlemen stand back to back."
The two opponents walked toward each other. The older man marched with vigor while the younger still stepped hesitantly and turned their backs to each other.
"You shall have 10 paces, said the younger man's second with bitter resignation. "Wait then, and on my signal you may turn and loose."
Slowly he counted out the steps. Slowly the two opponents walked away from each other. The younger man was shaking very badly indeed. Locke felt a ball of unaccustomed tension growing in his own stomach. Since when had he become such a damned soft-hearted fellow? Just because he preferred not to watch didn't mean he should be afraid to do so. Yet the feeling in his stomach paid no heed to the thoughts in his head.
9, 10. Stand fast," said the young duelist second. "Stand fast. Turn and loose."
The younger man whirled first, his face a mask of terror. He threw out his right hand and let fly. A sharp twang sounded across the green. His opponent didn't even jerk back as the bolt hissed through the air beside his head, missing by at least the width of a hand. The red-jacketed old man completed his own turn more slowly, his eyes bright and his mouth set into a scowl. His younger opponent stared at him for several seconds, as though trying to will his bolt to come flying back like a trained bird. He shuddered, lowered his crossbow, and then threw it down to the grass. With his hands on his hips, he stood waiting, breathing in deep and noisy gulps. His opponent regarded him briefly, then snorted.
"Be fucked," he said,
and he raised his crossbow in both hands. His shot was perfect. There was a wet crack, and the younger duelist toppled with a feathered bolt dead in the center of his chest. He fell onto his back, clawing at his coat and tunic, spitting up dark blood. Half a dozen spectators rushed toward him, while one young woman in a silver evening gown fell to her knees and screamed.
"We'll get back just in time for dinner," said the older duelist to nobody in particular.
He tossed his own crossbow carelessly to the ground behind him and stomped off toward one of the nearby chance houses with his second at his side.
"Sweet fucking Perelandro," said Locke, forgetting Leocanto Costa for a moment and thinking out loud. "What a way to manage things!"
"You don't approve, sir?"
A lovely young woman in a black silk dress regarded Locke with disconcertingly penetrating eyes. She couldn't have been more than 18 or 19.
"I understand that some differences of opinion need to be settled with steel," said Jean, butting in, appearing to recognize that Locke was still a bit too tipsy for his own good. "But standing before a crossbow bolt seems foolish. Blades strike me as a more honest test of skills."
Rapiers are tedious, all that back and forth, and rarely a killing strike right away, said the young woman. Bolts are fast, clean, and merciful. You can hack at someone all night with a rapier and fail to kill them.
I am quite compelled to agree with you, muttered Locke.
The woman raised an eyebrow but said nothing. A moment later she was gone, vanishing into the dispersing crowd. The contented murmur of the night, the laughter and chatter of the small clusters of men and women making time beneath the stars, had died briefly while the duel took place, but now it rose up once again. The woman in the silver dress beat her fists against the grass, sobbing, while the crowd around the fallen duelist seemed to sag in unison. The bolt's work was clearly done.
Fast, clean, and merciful, said Locke softly. Idiots!
Jean sighed.
Neither of us has any right to offer that sort of observation, since God's damned idiots is likely to be inscribed on our grave markers.
I've had reasons for doing what I've done, and so did you.
I'm sure those duelists felt the same way.
Let's get the hell out of here, said Locke. Let's walk off the fumes in my head and get back to the inn. Gods, I feel old and sour. I see things like this, and I wonder if I was that bloody stupid when I was that boy's age.
You were worse, said Jean, until quite recently. Probably still are.
5. Locke's melancholy slowly evaporated, along with more of his alcoholic haze, as they made their way down and across the golden steps, north by northeast, to the great gallery. The Eldrin craftsmen, craftswomen, craftsthings, responsible for Tal Varrar, had covered the entire district with an open-sided elderglass roof that sloped downward from its peak atop the sixth tier and plunged into the sea at the western island's base, leaving at least 30 feet of space beneath it at all points in between. Strange twisted glass columns rose up at irregular intervals, looking like leafless climbing vines carved from ice. The glass ceiling of the gallery was easily 1,000 yards from end to end the long way. Beyond the great gallery, on the lower layers of the island, was the portable quarter, open-faced tiers on which the miserably destitute were allowed to set up squatters' huts and whatever shelters they could construct from cast-off materials. The trouble was that any forceful wind from the north, especially in the rainy winter, would completely rearrange the place. Perversely, the district above and immediately southeast of the portable quarter, the Savrola, was a pricey expatriate's enclave, full of foreigners with money to waste. All the best inns were there, including the one Locke and Jean were currently using for their well-heeled alternate identities. The Savrola was sealed off from the portable quarter by high stone walls and heavily patrolled by Varrari constables and private mercenaries. By day, the great gallery was the marketplace of Tal Varrar. 1,000 merchants set up their stalls beneath it every morning, and there was room for 5,000 more, should the city ever grow so vast. Visitors rooming in the Savrola, who didn't travel by boat, were forced, by cunning coincidence, to walk across the full breadth of the market to travel to or from the Golden Steps. An east wind was up, blowing out from the mainland, across the glass islands and into the gallery. Locke and Jean's footsteps echoed in the darkness of the vast hollow space. Soft lamps on some of the glass pillars made irregular islands of light. Scraps of trash blew past their feet, and wisps of wood smoke from unseen fires. Some merchants kept family members sleeping in particularly desirable stall locations all night. And, of course, there were always vagrants from the portable quarter, seeking privacy in the shadows of the empty gallery. Patrols stomped through the gallery tiers several times each night, but there were none in sight at the moment.
"What a strange wasteland this place becomes after dark," said Jean. "I can't decide if I mislike it or if it enchants me."
"You'd probably be less inclined to enchantment if you didn't have a pair of hatchets stuffed up the back of your coat." They walked on for another few minutes. Locke rubbed his stomach and muttered to himself.
"Jean, are you hungry by chance?"
"I usually am," Need some more ballast for that liquor?
I think it might be a good idea. Damn that carousel. Another losing hand and I might have proposed marriage to that god's damned smoking dragoness, or just fallen out of my chair.
Well, let's raid the night market.
On the topmost tier of the great gallery, toward the northeastern end of the covered district, Locke could see the flickering light of barrel fires and lanterns and the shadowy shapes of several people. Commerce never truly ground to a halt in Tal'Varrar. With thousands of people coming and going from the Golden Steps, there was enough coin floating around for a few dozen nocturnal stallkeepers to stake out a spot just after sunset every evening. The night market could be a great convenience, and it was invariably more eccentric than its daytime counterpart. As Locke and Jean strolled toward the bazaar with the night breeze blowing against them, they had a fine view of the inner harbour with its dark forest of ships' masts. Beyond that, the rest of the city's islands lay sensibly sleeping, dotted here and there with specks of light rather than the profligate glow of the Golden Steps. At the heart of the city, the three crescent islands of the great guilds, alchemists, artificers, and merchants, curled around the base of the high, rocky Castellana like slumbering beasts. And atop the Castellana, like a looming stone hill planted in a field of mansions, was the dim outline of the Mon Magisteria, the fortress of the Archon. Tal'Varrar was supposedly ruled by the Priori, but in reality a significant degree of power rested in the man who resided in that palace, the city's master of arms. The office of the Archon had been created following Tal'Varrar's early disgraces in the Thousand-Day War against Camor, to take command of the army and navy out of the hands of the bickering merchant councils. But the trouble with creating military dictators, Locke reflected, was getting rid of them after the immediate crisis was past. The first Archon had declined retirement, and his successor was, if anything, even more interested in interfering with civic affairs. Outside guarded bastions of frivolity like the Golden Steps and expatriate havens like the Savrola, the disagreements between Archon and Priori kept the city on edge.
"Gentlemen,"
came a voice from their left, breaking into Locke's chain of thought.
"Honored sirs, a walk across the great gallery cannot possibly be complete without refreshment."
Locke and Jean had reached the fringes of the night market. There were no other customers in sight, and the faces of at least a dozen merchants stared keenly out at them from within their little circles of fire or lamplight. The first Varari to throw his pitch against the gates of their good judgment was a one-armed man getting on in years, with long white hair braided down to his waist. He waved a wooden ladle at them, indicating four small casks set atop a portable counter not unlike a flat-topped wheelbarrow.
"What's your fare?"
"Delicacies from the table of Yono himself, the sweetest taste the sea has to offer. Shark's eyes in brine, all fresh plucked. Crisp the shells, soft the humours, sweet the juices."
"Shark's eyes? God's no," Locke grimaced. "Have you more common flesh, liver, gills? A gill pie would be welcome."
"Gills? Sir, gills have none of the virtues of the eyes. It is the eyes that tone the muscles, prevent cholera, and firm up a man's mechanisms for certain, marital duties."
"I have no need of any mechanism firming in that respect," said Locke, "and I'm afraid my stomach is too unsettled for the splendour of shark's eyes at just the moment."
"A pity, sir. For your sake, I wish I had some bit of gill to offer you, but it's the eyes that I get, and little else. Yet I do have several types. Scythe sharks, wolf sharks, blue widower."
"We must pass, friend," said Jean, as he and Locke walked on.
"Fruit, worthy masters?"
The next merchant along was a slender young woman comfortably ensconced in a cream-coloured frock coat several sizes too large for her. She also wore a four-cornered hat with a small alchemical globe dangling on a chain, hanging down just above her left shoulder.
She stood watch over a number of woven baskets.
Alchemical fruit? Fresh hybrids? Have you ever seen the Sophia Orange of Camor? It makes its own liquor, very sweet and powerful.
We are acquainted, said Locke, and more liquor is not what I had in mind. Anything to recommend for an unsettled stomach?
Pears, sir. The world would have no unsettled stomachs if only we were all wise enough to eat several every day.
She took up one basket, about half full, and held it up before him. Locke sifted through the pears, which seemed firm and fresh enough, and drew out three.
5 centira, said the fruit seller.
A full Villani? Locke feigned outrage. Not if the Archon's favourite whore held them between her legs and wiggled for me. 1 centira is too much for the lot.
1 centira wouldn't buy you the stems. At least I won't lose money for 4.
It would be an act of supreme pity, said Locke, for me to give you 2. Fortunately for you, I'm bringing with largesse. The bounty is yours.
2 would be an insult to the men and women who grew those in the hot glass gardens of the Black Hands Crescent. But surely we can meet at 3.
3, said Locke with a smile. I have never been robbed in Tal Verar before, but I'm just hungry enough to allow you the honour. He passed 2 of the pears to Jean without looking, while fumbling in one of his coat pockets for copper. When he tossed 3 coins to the fruit seller, she nodded.
A good evening to you, Master Lamora.
Locke froze and fixed his eyes on her. I beg your pardon?
A good evening to you is all I said, worthy master.
You didn't...
Didn't what?
Nothing. Locke sighed nervously. I had a bit much to drink, is all. A fair evening to you as well.
He and Jean strolled away, and Locke took a tentative bite of his pear. It was in a fine state, neither too firm and dry nor too ripe and sticky.
Jean, he said between bites, did you hear what she said to me just now?
I'm afraid I heard nothing but the death cry of this unfortunate pair. Listen closely.
No, don't eat me, please. No.
Jean had already reduced his first pear to its core. As Locke watched, he popped this into his mouth, crunched it loudly, and swallowed it all but for the stem, which he flicked away.
13 gods, said Locke. Must you do that?
I like the cause, said Jean sulkily. All the little crunchy bits.
Goats eat the god's damned crunchy bits.
You're not my mother.
Well, true. Your mother would be ugly.
Oh, don't give me that look. Go on, eat your other core. It's got a nice juicy pear wrapped around it.
What did the woman say?
She said... Oh, God, she said nothing. I'm tipsy, is all.
Alchemical lantern, sirs?
A bearded man held his arm out toward them. At least 6 little lanterns in ornamental gilt frames hung from it.
A pair of well-dressed gentlemen should not be without light. Only scrubs scuttle about in darkness with no way to see. You'll find no better lanterns in all the gallery, not by night or day.
Jean waved the man off while he and Locke finished their pears. Locke carelessly tossed his core over his shoulder while Jean popped his into his mouth, taking pains to ensure that Locke was watching when he did.
He muttered with a half-full mouth. Ambrosial. But you'll never know, you and all your fellow culinary cowards.
Gentlemen, scorpions?
That brought Locke and Jean up short. The speaker was a cloaked, bald-headed man with the coffee-coloured skin of an Orcanti islander. The man was several 1,000 miles from home. His well-kept white teeth stood out as he smiled and bowed slightly over his wares. He stood over a dozen small wooden cages. Dark shapes could be seen moving about in several of them.
Scorpions? Real scorpions? Live ones?
Locke bent down to get a better look at the cages, but kept his distance.
What on earth for?
Why, you must be fresh visitors here.
The man's Therin had a slight accent.
Many on the Sea of Brass are only too familiar with the grey rock scorpion. Can you be Carthani, Camori?
Talishani, said Jean.
These are grey rock scorpions from here?
From the mainland, said the merchant, and their use is primarily, recreational.
Recreational? Are they pets?
Oh no, not really. The sting, you see. The sting of the grey rock scorpion is a complex thing. First there is pain, sharp and hot, as you might expect. But after a few minutes there is a pleasant numbness, a dreamy sort of fever. It is not unlike some of the powders smoked by Jeremites. After a few stings, a body grows more used to it. The pain lessens and the dreams deepen.
Astonishing.
Commonplace, said the merchant. Quite a few men and women in Talvera keep one close at hand, even if they don't speak of it in public. The effect is as pleasing as liquor, yet ultimately far less costly.
Locke scratched his chin. Never had to stab myself with a bottle of wine, though. And this isn't just some ruse, some amusement for visitors who wouldn't know any better?
The merchant's smile broadened. He extended his right arm and pulled back the sleeve of his cloak. The dark skin of his slender forearm was dotted with little circular scars.
I would never offer a product for which I was not prepared to vouch myself.
Admirable, said Locke, and fascinating, but perhaps there are some customs of Talvera best left unexplored.
To your own tastes be true.
Still smiling, the man pulled his cloak sleeve back up and folded his hands before him.
After all, a scorpion hawk was never to your liking, Master Lamora.
Locke felt a sudden cold pressure in his chest. He flicked a glance at Jean and found the larger man instantly tense as well. Struggling to maintain his outward calm, Locke cleared his throat.
I beg your pardon?
I'm sorry. The merchant blinked at him guilelessly. I merely wished you a pleasant night, gentlemen.
Right. Locke eyed him for a moment or two longer, then stepped back, turned on his heel, and began to walk across the night market once more. Jean was at his side immediately.
You heard that, whispered Locke.
Very clearly, said Jean. I wonder who our friendly scorpion merchant works for.
It's not just him, muttered Locke.
The fruit seller called me Lamora as well. You didn't hear that one, but I damn well did.
Shit.
Want to double back and grab one of them?
Going somewhere, Master Lamora?
Locke almost whirled on the middle-aged female merchant who stepped toward them from their right. He managed to keep the 6-inch stiletto concealed up his coat sleeve from flying reflexively into his hand. Jean put one arm beneath the back of his coat.
You seem to be mistaken, madam, said Locke. My name is Leocanto Costa.
The woman made no further move toward them. She merely smiled and chuckled.
Lamora, Locke Lamora.
Jean Denon,
said the scorpion merchant, who had stepped out from behind his little cage-covered table. Other merchants were moving slowly behind them, staring fixedly at Locke and Jean.
There seems to be a, misunderstanding afoot, said Jean.
He slid his right hand back out from under his coat. Locke knew from long experience that the head of one of his hatchets would be cupped in his palm, with the handle concealed up his sleeve.
No misunderstanding, said the scorpion merchant.
Thorn of Camor,
said a little girl who stepped out to block their progress toward the Savrola side of the great gallery.
Thorn of Camor,
said the middle-aged woman.
"Gentlemen bastards," said the scorpion merchant, "far from home."
Locke glanced around, his heart hammering in his chest. Deciding that the time for discretion was past, he let his stiletto fall into his itching fingers. All the merchants in the night market seemed to have taken an interest in them. They were surrounded, and the merchants were slowly tightening the circle. They cast long, dark shadows upon the stones at Locke and Jean's feet. Was Locke imagining things, or were some of the lights dimming? Already the night gallery seemed darker. Damn, some of the lanterns were indeed going out right before his eyes.
"That is far enough."
Jean let his hatchet fall visibly into his right hand. He and Locke pressed their backs against one another.
"No closer!" shouted Locke. "Cut the weird shit, or there's going to be blood."
"There has already been blood," said the little girl.
"Locke Lamora," muttered a soft chorus of the people surrounding them.
"There has already been blood, Locke Lamora," said the middle-aged woman.
The last alchemical lanterns within the periphery of the night market dimmed. The last few fires banked down, and now Locke and Jean faced the circle of merchants solely by the wan light coming from the inner harbour and from the eerie flicker of distant lamps beneath the vast, deserted gallery, much too far away for comfort. The little girl took one last step toward them, her eyes grey and unblinking.
"Master Lamora, Master Tannen,"
she said in her clear, soft voice.
"The Falconer of Carthane sends his regards."
6. Locke stared at the little girl, jaw half open. She glided forward like an apparition until just 2 paces separated them. Locke felt a pang of foolishness at holding a stiletto on a girl not yet 3 feet high, but then she smiled coldly in the near darkness, and the malice behind that smile steadied his hand on the hilt of the blade. The little girl reached up to touch her chin.
"Though he cannot speak," she said.
"Though he cannot speak for himself," chorused the circle of merchants, now motionless in the darkness.
"Though he is mad," said the girl,
slowly spreading her hands toward Locke and Jean, palms out.
"Mad beyond measure,"
whispered the circle.
"His friends remain," said the girl. "His friends remember."
Jean moved beside Locke, and then both of his hatchets were out, blackened steel heads naked to the night.
"These people are puppets. There are bonds magi somewhere around us," he hissed.
"Show yourselves, you fucking cowards," said Locke, speaking to the girl.
"We show our power," she replied.
"What more do you need?"
whispered the chorus in their ragged circle, their eyes empty as reflecting pools.
"What more do you need to see, Master Lamora?"
The little girl gave a sinister parody of a curtsy.
"Whatever you want," said Locke. "Leave these people out of it. Just fucking talk to us. We don't want to hurt these people."
"Of course, Master Lamora.
Of course," whispered the circle.
"Of course, that's the point," said the girl. "So you must hear what we have to say."
"State your God's damned business, then."
"You must answer," said the girl.
"Answer for the Falconer," said the chorus.
"You must answer, both of you."
"Of all the... fuck you," said Locke, his voice rising to a shout. "We did answer for the Falconer. Our answer was 10 lost fingers and a lost tongue for 3 dead friends. You got him back alive, and it was more than he deserved."
"Not for you to judge," hissed the girl.
"J-
"Judge the Magi of Carthane,"
whispered the circle.
"Not for you to judge, nor for you to presume a grasp of our laws," said the girl.
"All the world knows it's death to slay a bondsmage," said Jean. "That and little else. We let him live and took pains to return him to you. Our business is ended. If you wanted a more complicated treatment than that, you should have sent a fucking letter."
"This is not business," said the girl. "But personal," said the circle. "Personal," repeated the girl. "A brother has been bloodied. We cannot let this stand unanswered."
"You sons of bitches," said Locke. "You really think you're fucking gods, don't you? I didn't mug the falconer in an alley and take his purse. He helped murder my friends. I'm not sorry he's mad, and I'm not sorry for the rest of you. Kill us and get on with your business, or piss off and let these people go free." "No," said the scorpion merchant. A whispered chorus of "No" came from around the circle. "Cowards! Pissants!" Jean pointed one of his hatchets at the little girl as he spoke. "You can't scare us with this penny theatre bullshit." "If you force us to," said Locke, "we'll fight you with the weapons in our hands all the way to Carthane. You bleed like the rest of us. Seems to me all you can do is kill us."
"No," said the girl, giggling. "We can do worse," said the fruit seller.
"We can let you live," said the scorpion merchant.
"Live, uncertain," said the girl. "Uncertain," said the chorus of merchants as they began to step backward, widening their circle. "Watched," said the girl.
"Followed,"
said the circle.
"Now wait," said the girl. "Run your little games and chase your little fortunes."
"And wait,"
whispered the chorus.
"Wait for our answer. Wait for our time."
"You are always in our reach," said the little girl. "And you are always in our sight."
"Always,"
whispered the circle, slowly dispersing back to their stalls, back to the positions they'd held just a few minutes earlier.
"You will meet misfortune,"
said the little girl as she slipped away.
"For the falconer of Carthane."
Locke and Jean said nothing as the merchants around them resumed their places in the night market, as the lanterns and barrel fires gradually rose once more to flush the area with warm light. Then the affair was ended. The merchants resumed their former attitudes of keen interest or watchful boredom, and the babble of conversation rose up around them again. Locke and Jean slipped their weapons out of sight before anyone seemed to notice them.
"Gods," said Jean, shuddering visibly.
"I suddenly feel," Locke said quietly, "that I didn't drink nearly enough from that bloody carousel." There was mist at the edges of his vision. He put a hand to his cheeks and was surprised to find himself crying.
"Bastards," he muttered. "Infants, wretched, cowardly show-offs."
"Yes," said Jean. Locke and Jean began to walk forward once again, glancing warily around. The little girl who had done most of the speaking for the bonds magi was now sitting beside an elderly man, sorting through little baskets of dried figs under his supervision. She smiled shyly as they passed.
"I hate them," whispered Locke. "I hate this. Do you think they've really got something planned for us, or was that just a put-on?"
"I suppose it works either way," said Jean with a sigh.
"Gods! Strapiti! Do we flinch, or do we keep betting? Worst case, we've got a few thousand solari on record at the spire. We could cash out, take a ship, be gone before noon tomorrow."
Where to?
Anywhere else. There's no running from these assholes. Not if they're serious.
Yes, but...
Fuck Carthane! Locke clenched his fists. You know, I think I understand. I think I understand how the Grey King could feel the way he did. I've never even been there. But if I could smash Carthane, burn the fucking place, make the sea swallow it, I'd do it. Gods help me, I'd do it.
Jean suddenly came to a complete stop.
There's another problem, Locke. Gods forgive me.
What?
Even if you stay, I shouldn't. I'm the one who should be gone, as far from you as possible.
What the fuck nonsense is this?
They know my name.
Jean grabbed Locke by his shoulders, and Locke winced. That stone-hard grip didn't agree with the old wound beneath his left clavicle. Jean immediately realized his mistake and loosened his fingers, but his voice remained urgent.
My real name, and they can use it. They can make me a puppet, like these poor people. I'm a threat to you every moment I'm around you.
I don't bloody well care that they know your name. Are you mad?
No, but you're still drunk, and you're not thinking straight.
I certainly am. Do you want to leave?
No, gods no, of course not. But I'm...
Shutting up right this second if you know what's good for you.
You need to understand that you're in danger.
Of course I'm in danger. I'm mortal. Jean, gods love you, I will not fucking send you away, and I will not let you send yourself away. We lost Carlo, Galdo, and Bug. If I send you away, I lose the last friend I have in the world. Who wins then, Jean? Who's protected then?
Jean's shoulders slumped, and Locke suddenly felt the beginning of the transition from fading inebriation to pounding headache. He groaned.
Jean, I will never stop feeling awful for what I put you through in Vel Verazzo. And I will never forget how long you stayed with me when you should have tied weights around my ankles and thrown me in the bay. Gods help me, I will never be better off without you. I don't care how many bonds mage I know your damned name.
I wish I could be sure you knew best about this.
This is our life, said Locke. This is our game that we've put 2 years into. That's our fortune waiting for us to steal it at the Sin Spire. That's all our hopes for the future. So fuck Carthane. They want to kill us. We can't stop them. So what else can we do? I won't jump at shadows on account of those bastards. On with it. Both of us together.
Most of the night market merchants had taken note of the intensity of Locke and Jean's private conversation and had avoided making further pitches. But one of the last merchants on the northern fringe of the night market was either less sensitive or more desperate for a sale and called out to them.
Curved amusements, gentlemen? Something for a woman or a child in your lives? Something artful from the city of artifice?
The man had dozens of exotic little toys on an upturned crate. His long, ragged brown coat was lined on the inside with quilted patches in a multitude of garish colours, orange, purple, cloth of silver, mustard yellow. He dangled the painted wood figure of a spear-carrying soldier by 4 cords from his left hand, and with little gestures of his fingers he made the figure thrust at an imaginary enemy.
A marionette? A little puppet for memory of Tal Verar?
Jean stared at him for a few seconds before responding.
For memory of Tal Verar, he said quietly. I would want anything, beg pardon, before I would want a puppet.
Locke and Jean said nothing else to each other. With an ache around his heart to match the one growing in his head, Locke followed the bigger man out of the great gallery and into the Savrola, eager to be back behind high walls and locked doors, for what little it might prove to be worth. Reminiscence, The Cape of Vel Verazzo. 1. Locke Lamora had arrived in Vel Verazzo nearly 2 years earlier, wanting to die, and Jean Tannen had been inclined to let him have his wish. Velvirazzo is a deep water port about 100 miles southeast of Tal Vera, carved out of the high rocky cliffs that dominate the mainland coast on the Sea of Brass. A city of 8,000 or 9,000 souls, it has long been a sullen tributary of the Verari, ruled by a governor appointed directly by the Archon. A line of narrow elderglass spires rises 200 feet out of the water just offshore, one more Eldrin artifact of inscrutable function on a coast thick with abandoned wonders. The glass pylons have 15-foot platforms atop them, and are now used as lighthouses, manned by petty convicts. Boats will leave them to climb up the knotted rope ladders that hang down the pylons. That accomplished, they winch up their provisions and settle in for a few weeks of exile, tending red alchemical lamps the size of small huts. Not all of them come back down right in the head, or live to come back down at all. 2 years before that fatal game of Carousel Hazard, a heavy galleon swept in toward Velvirazzo under the red glow of those offshore lights. The hands atop the galleon's yardarms waved, half in pity and half in jest, at the lonely figures atop the pylons. The sun had been swallowed by thick clouds on the western horizon, and a soft, dying light rippled across the water beneath the first stars of evening. A warm, wet breeze was blowing from shore to sea, and little threads of mist seemed to be leaking out of the grey rocks to either side of the old port town. The galleon's yellowed canvas topsails were close-reefed as she prepared to lay to about half a mile offshore. A little harbourmaster's skiff scudded out to meet the galleon, green and white lanterns bobbing on its bow to the rhythm of the 8 heaving oarsmen.
"What vessel?"
The harbourmaster stood up beside her bow lanterns and shouted through a speaking trumpet from 30 yards away.
"Golden Gain, Tal Vera,"
came the return shout from the galleon's waist.
"Do you wish to put in?"
"No, passengers only, coming off by boat."
The lower stern cabin of the Golden Chain smelled strongly of sweat and illness. Jean Tannen was newly returned from the upper deck and had lost some of his tolerance for the odour, which lent further edge to his bad mood. He flung a patched blue tunic at Locke and folded his arms.
"For fuck's sake," he said, "we're here. We're getting off this bloody ship and back onto good solid stone. Put the bloody tunic on. They're lowering a boat."
Locke shook the tunic out with his right hand and frowned. He was sitting on the edge of a bunk, dressed only in his breeches, and was thinner and dirtier than Jean had ever seen him. His ribs stood out beneath his pale skin like the hull timbers of an unfinished ship. His hair was dark with grease, long and unkempt on every side, and a fine thistle of beard fringed his face. His upper left arm was crisscrossed with the glistening red lines of barely sealed wounds. There was a scabbed puncture on his left forearm, and beneath that a dirty cloth brace was wound around his wrist. His left hand was a mess of fading bruises. A discoloured bandage partially covered an ugly-looking injury on his left shoulder, a scant few inches above his heart. Their 3 weeks at sea had done much to reduce the swelling of Locke's cheeks, lips, and broken nose, but he still looked as though he'd tried to kiss a kicking mule, repeatedly.
"Can I get a hand, then?"
"No, you can do it for yourself. You should have been exercising this past week, getting ready. I can't always be here to hover about like your fairy fucking nursemaid."
"Well, let me shove a goddamned rapier through your shoulder and wiggle it for you, and then let's see how keen you are to exercise."
"I took my cuts, you sobbing pisswallow, and I did exercise 'em."
Jean lifted his own tunic. Above the substantially reduced curve of his once prodigious belly was the fresh, livid scar of a long slash across his ribs.
"I don't care how much it hurts. You have to move around, or they heal tight like a cork seal, and then you're really in the shit."
"So you keep telling me."
Locke threw the shirt down on the deck beside his bare feet.
But unless that tunic animates itself, or you do the honors, it seems I go to the boat like this.
Sun's going down. Summer or not, it's going to be cool out there. But if you want to be an idiot, I guess you do go like that.
You're a son of a bitch, Jean.
If you were healthy, I'd re-break your nose for that, you self-pitying little...
Gentlemen?
A crewwoman's muffled voice came through the door, followed by a loud knock.
Captain's compliments, and the boat is ready.
Thank you, yelled Jean.
He ran a hand through his hair and sighed.
Why did I bother saving your life again? I could have brought the Grey King's corpse. Would have been better fucking company.
Please, said Locke forcefully, gesturing with his good arm. We can meet in the middle. I'll pull with my good arm and you handle the bad side. Get me off this ship and I'll get to exercising.
Can't come soon enough, said Jean,
and after another moment's hesitation he bent down for the tunic.